Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about the release of the new film Crazy Rich Asians and how it could shape Hollywood's diversity efforts in the future. It's an evil. First, music legend Aretha Franklin died today at her home in Detroit at the age of 76. Franklin is widely regarded as the Queen of Soul and was the voice behind some of the most well-known songs in the 20th century, including Respect, Chain of Fools, and Say a Little Prayer. Among her many accolades, she was the first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987, and she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2005. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. Central Time producer Dean Kennetter talked about Franklin's musical legacy with him earlier today.
Aretha was surrounded by music from a very early age. Her father was a famous Baptist minister, and there were a lot of musical luminaries stopping by their home in Detroit. How did those early years impact her style?
Well, those early years were fundamental. In a sense, Aretha Franklin was really a daughter of the Great Migration itself. Being in Detroit, one of the prime locations for many African Americans who moved from the South to the North during this period, and her father, C.L. Franklin, became a nationally and internationally known Baptist preacher. He was incredible as a performer, in a sense, in his own right. And as his fame and popularity grew, he came to know many of the great musicians of the time, whether it was Mahalia Jackson or Clara Ward, countless musicians who would often not just stop by the church, but often visit his home. They would often stay with him at times. And so from a very early age, Aretha was around some of the great singers of all time. But it's also worth noting that the tables were turned, because those luminaries would show up at their home and they would hear a young Aretha sing.
And
they would be overwhelmed by what they would hear, that they knew from the very start that she had a gift and that there was something special there that was going to really be transcendent, and that turned out to be the case.
But as good as she was, success was not immediate. It kind of took her finding the right production team and the right studio band, and that seemed to happen down in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. What did she find there?
Well, what she found there was the gospel sound that she had grown up with, and I'll back up for a moment and explain what I mean by that. She had grown up around the gospel church and had started out being a gospel singer. It was clear that she had an extraordinary talent, and John Hammond, one of the great talent scouts of all time, he signed Aretha to Columbia Records, and there are some really fine songs on those Columbia albums that she cut, but there was an attempt to create a record that would sound like it was part of the pop canon, almost part of the pre-rock and soul canon, recording show tunes and Tin Pan Alley records. And that is something I should note that Aretha wanted to do, because she wanted to have a far-reaching kind of sound. She wanted to embody all that was good about American music. But it didn't capture the gospel and blues roots of her singing style. And that happens at Atlantic with Muscle Shoals, Alabama. What happens is that she signs to Atlantic after Columbia finally gives up on her, which still sounds astonishing today, but it was multiple albums later when they just couldn't figure out how to break her as a star. So Atlantic signed her, Jerry Wexler in particular, and decided that what she needed to do was go and play with Southern soul musicians and use that space to write songs and to interpret songs and to play piano in a way that would really draw out what was her strength in the first place, which was this gospel soul singing style.
It sounds like part of the key was letting her use her own talent. Like you said, playing piano, taking people to church, and kind of running the studio.
That's right. And that is significant for a number of reasons. Obviously, it was incredibly significant for Aretha's career, because by the time you get to 1967 or 1968, she has become a star as a result of having the freedom to produce the music the way that she wanted to produce it. It's also representative of how she was a trailblazer and changing the way that music itself was being recorded. This was particularly true for female artists, because they found themselves often before Aretha having to listen to the largely white producers, songwriters, and studio record executives who ran the music industry. And so although they would find ways to negotiate all of that and have their own voice heard, Aretha got the opportunity to really take control of her career and to take control of her voice, and not just her singing voice, but what she wanted to say. And what she wanted to say in 1967 and 1968 was about freedom, It was about respect, of course. It was about change.
And today she's being remembered definitely for that cultural impact, but also an artistic one as well. Undoubtedly one of the greatest singers of all time. And when you listen to those early Atlantic records we were talking about, you can hear her routinely overpowering the mics and the recording equipment. It's almost as if they weren't quite ready for what she was bringing to the table. When you listen to those songs, how do you hear her raising the bar for singers?
It's a bar that in many ways has yet to be surpassed.
I'm sure
that there are good arguments. I know there are good arguments for other singers who have come since and in their own way have raised the bar, right? But when you hear people talk about what Aretha was like in the studio, they're all just astonished at the power, the consistency of her voice, you know, the perfect pitch. It seemingly was effortless. Now, we know that that's not true. We know that she worked hard at maintaining her voice and growing her voice. Like any other artist, she worked hard to get to where she was. But she was given an extraordinary gift, a gift to be able to sing in such a wide range, to sing those high notes and to be able to scream when that scream was required, and yet at the same time to dig deep and to hear almost bass notes in her voice when she needed those too. It is, you know, it is an incredible legacy, and all of the great singers that followed her in the 1970s, whether it was someone who was sort of following along in terms of phrasing, like maybe Patti LaBelle or you know, certainly Gladys Knight and Dusty Springfield, for example, they were all trying in one way or another to figure out what to do with this incredible singer who was out there, who had indeed raised the bar for every other singer who was out there, and not just every female singer, every other singer who was out there. There's a reason why Rolling Stone put her number one on their list of the greatest singers of all time, right? That's not an accident. It's because everyone sees her as the model for what can be achieved by a human voice.
Well, Alexander, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Alexander Shashko of the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. Dean Kinetter was also able to talk about Franklin's cultural impact with UW-Madison Afro-American Studies Professor Tulani Davis.
Well, a big part of Aretha's legacy is her identity. There had been mainstream African-American female singers before, but for someone to be on the radio singing with that level of assuredness and fire, did that do something socially beyond music?
I think it was at an intensity level that a lot of other things in the culture were at the time. There were, one or two years later, there was Richard Pryor, who was just knocking down walls of propriety, for instance. Mm-hmm. There was the intensity of political speech at the time, which was very freewheeling, and feminist speech. People were burning bras in Atlantic City. There was Fannie Lou Hamer at the Democratic Convention in 68, a sharecropper who was an organizer, saying to America things they had never heard, and certainly never from a black woman who picked cotton in the South. So Aretha fit right in the landscape, but she was offering us a kind of consolation, a kind of inspiration, courage, and also her voice was very percussive in a way that mm-hmm. other singers weren't, and it also soared to places that other singers did not. So it was an intense, inspiring experience to hear her.
And how do you think her gospel roots, her history there, informed her place in the civil rights movement?
Partly, I would say also it's the instrumental part of gospel music. She played, when she played the piano, it was straight out of gospel, and there was a driving intensity to it, also a percussive aspect to it mm-hmm. that we don't, or we didn't associate with sacred music in mainstream America. So there was, she could drive a song and drive the whole room with the gospel intonations and with the rhythms that she put on the piano.
And Aretha didn't often explicitly sing about politics or the civil rights movement on the surface, but she became a very a known figure in that regard. How did she maintain that identity or create it without singing explicitly about the news of the day?
Well, I think she actually did so by accepting the mantles we put on her. When those songs became anthems for movements, she accepted that. Mm-hmm. She expressed her politics in part by where she showed up to do it. And she would allow people to use her both to raise money for the movement and also to make... more present, make a larger impression of an event that was about the movement. And then, of course, showing up and singing at King's funeral, places like that. She took the mantle that I think really was given to her by her listeners and fans.
Well, Tulani, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was UW-Madison Professor Tulani Davis speaking with Central Time producer Dean Kinetter. They looked back at the legacy of the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin.